Okay. Good afternoon. This is session Grow Up. But how? Becoming an adult. My name is Alphonse Keesley, as the placard probably shows you here, and I will be the moderator for this particular session. And on the panel, we have, starting at the far end there, Allison Delfume. Sorry about that. Who is quite a number of different things. She's in the music industry. She included playing, writing, and engineering, and producing, and development and management of music, journalism, publicity, social media, and more recently promoting music industry education to peers and university students. She'll be a part of our panel, and she'll be bringing up the end of this session today. And we also have on the panel Karuna Jagger, who's sitting right next to me. Karuna's work is primarily in the area of breast cancer action. There are other things that you can read in her bio that she speaks about, but there's one particular part that caught my attention that I thought would be worth emphasizing as well. She's been doing a lot of the work to bring the issues, to give voice to issues related to breast cancer and when others are not taking action. We've just been having a fantastic conversation about lots of things related to children and language and growing, so quite an engaged conversation. And the gentleman who's going to actually start our session today is Frank Strasburger, who has a book that he's written on growing up. And that's going to be the way in which we're going to kick off today's panel. Before we go into the specifics of the panel is speaking for between 7 and 10 minutes, and I'll just sort of remind you guys of that. In this particular CWA session, we'll use the note card system. One of my students this morning was going to help me with using the live session, but in this session we use note cards, and the gentleman standing to, you'll see over there, as well as the young lady standing in the back, the producers for this particular session, will bring you note cards and pencils so that you can write down your questions. Please raise your hand when you're interested in receiving a note card and pencil so that they can get them to you. And please, students, of which we have quite a number, good to see you all, please indicate on the card if you are in fact a student when you write that. Thanks. So let's go ahead and get started with Frank Strasburger.
Hi. Allison was commenting a minute ago that this is by far the youngest audience we've had, at least on our panels. And I want to suggest that that's because you're a lot more perceptive than your elders, not just because you can't see us, but because you understand you're growing up. Your elders don't seem to understand they're still doing it too. I'm 71 and I'm still trying to figure out what I'm going to do when I grow up. So I guess it was about 6 years ago that my wife and I were at Skidmore College, where our youngest went, and he was a senior, so we decided we could skip what would have been our 12th President Talks to the Parents routine. But in fact, in the following hour when we had a meeting, somebody said, "Did you hear what Phil Gosbach said, President of Skidmore College?" And of course we hadn't. And so the person repeated it. He said, "These days it takes them until they're 35 to grow up." And I was horrified. I thought, oh my gosh, we can't afford that. And neither can they. So that really was the genesis of the book I ended up writing. And I'm now going to participate in a little bit of shameless self-promotion, because this book, Growing Up, Limiting Adolescence in a World Desperate for Adults, is not in the CWA bookshop. They somehow forgot to order it. But you can get it on Amazon. Strasburger, Growing Up. So what made me write the book? As I thought about what Phil Gosbach had said, I thought, I think the problem is we're not really helping these kids grow up because we're not giving them the right benchmarks. I mean, what are the benchmarks that we give you for growing up? You could shout them out.
Paying bills.
Anybody else?
Moving out of your parents' house.
You got it. Now, you notice it was a parent, I think. Getting a job, having an independent income, getting married, having children, buying a house. You know, that's when you're a grown-up, right? But there's a problem with that. You and I know a whole lot of people who can check off all the boxes, and they're not really adults. I wasn't going to do this, but I can't help it. I think we have one in the White House. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done it. Yeah. Those aren't really the measures of adulthood. So that sent me to thinking, what are, if those aren't? And I spent a lot of time thinking about that. And I came down to two. You're an adult when you begin seriously to wrestle with your mortality. And when you recognize you're not the center of the universe. So let me explain a little of what I mean by that. Wrestling with your mortality isn't just about wrestling with the fact that you're going to die, though that is definitely a large part of it, but it's also understanding that you're limited. You know, how many of your parents told you you can do anything you set your mind to, anything you want? You can be anything you want to be. Anybody? Come on. I know your parents have it. I said it to my kids. It's a setup, guys. It's not true. Why do we do it? Because we want you to dream big dreams. But the fact is, you can't do everything, and you are right at a point when you're beginning to get that. You know? I mean, first of all, you're going to take a path that isn't a different path. And it may be the road not taken, but taking the road not taken is not taking another road. So, there's a lot you can't do, like being in two places at once, and so on. We are all limited. And growing up is partly about coming to grips with our limits. It's also, and related to that, about realizing there are other people out there. You know, we're all born thinking that all those people out there are here to serve us. And what the rest of life is about is finding out we're here to serve them. Some people never get to that, and some people never grow up. So, part of the understanding that we're not here alone, and it's not all about us, is finding out something of a miracle. And that is that who we are isn't who we thought we were. You know, I mean, I think most of us start out when we think about identity, and we know who we are. You know, you can look at yourself in the mirror and so on. But your identity doesn't end at the end of your skin. I said this, I think you were there, at a panel yesterday. Our identities include everybody we've ever known and everybody we haven't. They include your great-great-great-great-grandparents whose DNA is big in you, and you never met them. Includes people on the other side of the world, includes everybody you love, and guess what? It includes everybody you hate. Think about how much psychic energy you spend on the people you don't like, and then tell me that they aren't part of who you are. The point is, our identities aren't just about us we always thought we were. Our identities are about all those other people. And part of growing up is being able to get out of ourselves and embrace the other. And the other includes all those people, and maybe most of all, includes all those people who seem totally strange to us. People we're afraid of. People we sure don't want to include in our identity, but guess what? It's already happened. So becoming an adult is being willing to wrestle through that stuff. Being willing to come out of the self you thought you were and embrace the self that you really are. I think I'm going to stop there, and I know we'll have lots more to talk about.
Just to remind you, if you have questions, make sure that you raise your hands and look at the individuals who are standing in the aisles and to give you a paper and pencil. All right, thank you.
Well, hi. I have to say that this is really exciting to see everyone, so many young faces here, and I think that if you're looking to us to give you answers on how to grow up, I am so sorry to disappoint. You should have gone to Liz Winstead's Molly Ivins lecture, because I feel so humbly clear that I do not have the answers. And I don't know if you know anything about this, the WAA conference, but they put us on panels where we have some expertise and panels where we don't necessarily have expertise. And I think that I'm on here on this panel because I am an adult. I'm an adult who probably started young. Alice and I were talking about this before. I wanted to grow up early. I wanted all the privileges that comes with the responsibilities of growing up. So I started shouldering responsibilities in my early teens. And, you know, I was told at 13 that I was 13 going on 30. So I have some expertise in growing up just as somebody who's done it. I'm also a parent. And I want to just be really transparent here that I probably missed the mark in thinking about this panel. So many of my other panels have been just basically a sea of gray heads. And so I was expecting more of that, and I was thinking that what folks might want to talk about is parenting and how to raise an adult. But I see that actually we've got a lot of young adults wanting to talk about being an adult. So I'm going to try to make some adaptations and hopefully, you know, we'll have a really good discussion.
I'll bet they have some thoughts about how to parent and how not to.
So again, this is my first EWA conference, and one of the panelists on Sunday night, you know, I was on a panel this morning called Sex and Robots, and I was a little daunted, and some of the panelists who've been here before said, just Google it. So I did last night Google being an adult, and it was really funny. The first answer I got was, "So it turns out, growing up is mostly just Googling how to do stuff." But I'm also a child of the 70s, and I do read books, and I'm going to do a little piece of my the stuff that I was planning to share on parenting. One of the most, listen, if you parents through pregnancy, you know, you've got this like visible marker that parenthood is impending, and people want to talk to you about what you're going to do and all the choices you have and what books you should read, and they start piling on advice. And a lot of it is just overwhelming and makes you feel like, oh my gosh, this is like, I don't know, I'm going to be inadequate no matter what it is. It's contradictory advice, it's this and that, and I just, you know, I would always say, I don't know if I'm going to use disposable or whatever diapers. I'm going to start with this and see how it goes. I don't know if I'm going to co-sleep. I don't know if I'm going to start with this and we'll see how it goes. But the one book that really stood out to me was given to me by my father. And it was an older book by a woman called Magda Gerber. And it's R.I.E., I think it's like, well, never mind. It's R.I.E. philosophy is what it stands for. And I can't tell you what it stands for. But the kind of crux of it, this is for parenting infants, and it really informs my parenting philosophy with my now 9 and 12 year olds. So here's somebody who's saying with infants, we're talking like helpless blobs that can't turn over. Her philosophy is you begin from a place of respect for and trust in the baby to be an initiator, an explorer, and self-learner. And she encouraged parents and caregivers to provide, I did Google this, an environment for the child that's physically safe, cognitive challenging, and emotionally nurturing. So kind of basically make the box and then give the baby space to explore that box in that, you know, kind of air quotes. Time for uninterrupted play and freedom to explore. Involvement of the child in all care activities to allow the child to become an active participant rather than a passive recipient. So imagine approaching changing a baby's diaper where you're involving the baby. They're not just like an object and you have this dirty task to do. You're actually using this as a moment to engage with and interact with, and they're participating in having their diaper changed. Sensitive observation of the child in order to sound, understand his or her needs. And for me, this really kind of is going to, I'll come back to this. And consistently and clearly defined limits and expectations to develop discipline. You know, I mean, before I had kids, I had a dog. Dog training is as much about training the owner as it is the dog, but it's about consistency, you know. I know that makes people uncomfortable when I compare parenting to dog training, but it is so true. So what that means is that when you have an infant, you're not interrupting them and like shaking bells in front of their faces. You're saying, like, actually an infant in the world is learning and, you know, is watching the shadows as the air blows the curtain and feeling the breeze on their face. And that thing of really respecting that we don't, that what's happening is learning, I think is really important carryover into kids of older ages and also young adults. And the end of it, so that is to say, we privilege certain kinds of learning in this society, right? And we overschedule our kids. And we think they have to learn piano and Mandarin and play soccer and be artists. And it's, you know, it's a recipe for feeling very unsuccessful. And again, I have a 9 and a 12-year-old. I value physical activity. In our family, you have to do a sport. And a sport is both physical and involves team. And that's a value that is important to me. And I convey that. You can pick the, here, you know, I have one role. Here's the things that are required in our family. They get to pick what sport. I don't care what sport they play. And I think there's something about staying in your lane, knowing what's your job and what's the kid or parent's job, depending which lens you're taking. And the only other piece of advice, or not advice, parenting, back this up. How many of you have either been told to clear your plate or eat your vegetables or this or that or told that to someone else, right? It's so common. You're micromanaging their eating, for God's sake. And we don't even trust people to choose what food goes in their mouth. And I slipped into this. You know, I'm around all these other parents saying the same things to their kids, and it's really easy to like slip into that. And I thought, wait a minute, this is not how I want to be. This is not my, like, I don't want to have this relationship of nagging with my kids. And I had talked to a friend about it, and she gave me the other great book parenting book that I read. And it said, you got two, I basically believe this about so many things, like stay in your lane, know your job, and do your job, not someone else's job. So here it is. Parents' job is what, when, and where to eat. Kids' job is if and how much to eat. So parents say, this is the food we're serving. Kids are not, and it has to be child-friendly, appropriate food, you know, whatever has to meet their food allergies. It has to be palatable and basically good, right, nutritious. But within that, it's kids' decision to figure out what of that they're going to eat. Parents decide when, and, you know, they have to plan and know that toddlers are going to need snacks or they're going to have a meltdown. So there is a responsibility on parents to provide, you know, food in a timely, appropriate way. But kids decide, no, I'm actually not hungry. And you don't push your kids to do this, like, preemptive eating, you know, like, eat now or you'll be hungry later. Like, if they're not hungry, teach them to respect that sensation in their body. And how much? Same thing, like this pressure to clear your plate, like allow, respect that. This is like the first piece of body autonomy. So those are two things that I have found to be really, you know, it's about early childhood, but it informs my parenting across the board. And at the end of the day, I think my basic job as a parent is to know and nurture my kids and to, and myself. I feel like, maybe let me spread this, say this isn't about parenting, this is about being an adult. So my view on being an adult is that really our jobs is to know and nurture ourselves. And that means give up on perfection, like throw that out the window, and know that we each come with our own unique traits and temperaments and responsibilities, you know, just outlooks. And none of those are good or bad inherently. Every quality has a good or a bad side. Every quality is wonderful in some contexts and challenging in other contexts. And I'll give one example from my oldest child was the two-year-old that never hit another kid, always used her words. Well, here's what would happen. A kid would grab the toy and my child would, you know, immediately go to an adult and say, you know, so-and-so took my toy, I need some adult help. And the adults would force the other kid to give the toy back and the kid would cry. And then my kid would be like, they can have it. And that sounds like all the parents are like, oh, that's so amazing. How did you get a kid like that? That's incredible. Well, sometimes being generous is incredible. But sometimes not. Sometimes you want a kid to stand up for themselves and, you know, actually say, sorry, you're out of luck. It's my turn now. That's a piece of equity. And so, again, I feel like, accepting that we all come with temperaments and outlooks and preferences, and they're not good or bad, that they serve us in some contexts and they're challenging in other contexts. And so our job is to figure out how to manage when they're not serving us, and how to put ourselves in situations where our natural tendencies really thrive and power.
Thank you.
Hello, my name's Allison, I'm 21, I go to University of Oregon, and I'm like stoked that I'm not the youngest person in the room this week. It's a big deal. Growing up, when I first found out I was on this panel, at first I thought it was a little hypocritical. You know, I'm growing up, how am I supposed to tell other people how to grow up? And as I was thinking about last night, I realized my entire life, all I've wanted is to grow up. You know, I think every kid wants to be treated as an adult or, you know, well, mom, like, I can stay out later than you think I can, or I don't have to be home at 10 o'clock. And when I was 8 years old, I started my first business. Because I thought, you know, growing up means you start your own business. And it wasn't a real business. What I did was I had the home newspaper. So throughout the week, things would happen in the household. Someone forgot to clean the dishes, and I would write a newspaper about everything that happened in the house. And I thought I was so clever, and I would print them out. It was like my first computer that I had, and like Microsoft Word was really crappy, and if you were trying to import photos. And I did that, and then when I was 9, you know, I was having this thriving journalist career, I decided to make my own business cards, and I would, like, cut out newspaper, and then I put, like, stickers on them and whatever. And my grandpa still actually has my business card, so if anyone ever wants to see a picture of it. But, you know, it kind of just, like, made me reflect last night on, you know, I'm only 21 years old, but I have done a lot as a 21-year-old, and I feel very, very fortunate to do that. And, you know, the one thing I've learned, especially since going to college, is that growing up is completely overrated. Like, it's, you know, we talk about what is growing up? Like, what does that mean? It's growing up, you know, you go to college and you graduate and you get a job and you meet someone, you get married and you have kids. Or what does that even mean? Because some people don't get married. Some people don't have kids. But does that mean they didn't grow up? And some people didn't even go to college. And so what I've realized is, like, to me, in the last few years, you know, growing up is about figuring out your values. You know, what makes you get up in the morning, and what makes you smile, and, you know, finding purpose, and whether that be in, you know, your purpose as a career, or making people happy, or, you know, doing community service. And I think, to me, you know, growing up is finding these, you know, these meaningful moments in your life that are things 10 years down the line you're going to be proud of. So I was reflecting on all these things, and it kind of made me reflect on my roommates. I live with 3 other girls in a townhouse, and we have all these different levels. I live on the main level, and, you know, even though we all go to the same school, and we're all in the same major and we all have the same friends. We all are so different and on our journeys. And I definitely would say I was the one that came to college. You know, I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to work in music and I've been doing that, but I also have one roommate who has absolutely no idea what she wants to do. You know, so looking at, you know, on the outside when we put papers growing up and being successful is, well, you know, are you going to college or are you getting a job? But when I look at my roommates, you know, all my roommates on paper sound like they're growing up, but in a lot of ways they're not. And I think in all different ways, we're all lost on different things. And, you know, I'm very confident in who I am and one of my other roommates is too, but I'm not always confident in how I treat other people or that I have like a very low patience level. You know, that's something I'm working on. And like, that's how I'm growing up at like this part in my life. And so, you know, I'm sure there will be questions and all that kind of stuff, but my main point is that growing up is not just about the materialistic things. Growing up is about, you know, like being able to wake up in the morning, look yourself in the mirror, and like be proud of who you are, so.
Okay, let's see, questions, please. Raise your hand to get a note card to write down a question that we'll be able to ask the panelists. I'll get something started right now of the panelists, recognizing that we have a younger emerging adult. Let me ask you, those of you who've been around, what is it that you like most about being an adult?
Freedom to do what I want when I want. I mean, you know, I have been a responsible person since I was young. I had a dog that was my dog and not a family dog when I was 12. So this dog lived for 14 years. From the time I was 12 to basically 26 or 27, I walked the dog 15 minutes in the morning before I went to school, an hour after I came home from school, 15 minutes before bed. I've had a lot of responsibility my whole life. But the thing is, it's not about the weight of the responsibility, it's about within that, there's so much freedom, right? Within that, like, yeah, I gotta walk a dog, but where I walk the dog, when I walk the dog, who do I walk the dog with? And so for me, this piece of like finding the freedom and just, I love that. I love taking a road trip because you can just go where you wanna go, get in the car, stop if you want.
I'm gonna answer that in part by responding to something Allison said. When you said adulthood isn't all it's cracked up to be. I think as you look at adulthood, well, really from either side, my side or some of yours, it's easy to look at adulthood and say, oh my gosh, yeah, I really gotta get serious. I'm not really sure I wanna get serious. I don't think adulthood has to be serious. Adulthood isn't about getting rid of the child in you, it's getting rid of the childish. And so for me, what I am enjoying about becoming an adult is learning to respect my child, learning to leave the childish part of me behind, and my wife, who isn't here, would be quick to tell you I can altogether learn to do that. I'm going to say something that sounds way off topic, but it's right on topic. Learning to love. And can I say, when you learn to love, and that too is a sometime thing, there's nothing better. When you are able to empower another person to become themselves, which is really what love is about, you become the biggest you can be, and that's really cool.
I don't know, I feel like I'm still growing up, so I don't know, one big thing for me was like the first time I got a car. I feel like that is such like a monument, you know, like it's a pivotal moment in your freedom, and so I don't know, like, I guess my favorite thing about growing up and being an adult is, you know, finally being able to make decisions and kind of almost take control of your destiny. I think a lot of the times, you know, a lot of people have helicopter parents, and I was lucky not to really have helicopter parents, but, you know, there's still a level of that you know, when you go to school and you come home and you have someone that you have to call and let know where you are. But I definitely feel like I've actually been able to do more now that I'm in college, because I don't feel like an immense amount of pressure to always have to be somewhere at a specific time. So I guess that'd be my favorite thing thus far.
So I have one question here that asks, how does each of you feel about the term adulting? Yeah, that's a good question. What does the term adulting mean?
Oh, okay.
Well, adulting is better than the word millennial, so I think adulting like makes sense though, because there's like certain, like adulting means like you're doing something and you're being adult, like you're going in for an interview, oh, you're adulting. Does that make sense?
It's like tongue-in-cheek, right? And it's like kind of the crappy part of adulting, right? So when you're adulting, you're like, this is the part I have to do because I have to pretend to be an adult. It's the responsibility downside, right? And
go for it.
I think the question was how we feel about it.
Yes.
So that's like, it's just like reality. It's like when you're an adult, you have to go to the grocery store and buy groceries. Like, is that like a negative thing? Like, you just have to do that. So I don't know. Like, I've always heard people say like, oh, like you're adulting as it's a negative thing. But I don't know. I really don't like that slang term. Any thoughts?
As you said, there are times in our lives when we all have to do things, you know, that we wouldn't necessarily put on a tie to do, you know, but what the heck, it makes mom happy, I'll do it. So you do it. It's not the core of who you are, and you make that separation and realize that's not what adulthood is about. That's just sort of playing the game.
A related question, I think, from the audience that fits with this, I guess this is for each of you as well. What do you think about adultism? I'm assuming it's an ism, so.
So I'm just going to start and say, you already gathered I had a little bit of a non-traditional childhood. I said this in an earlier panel. When I was in immigrant parents, when I was in grade school, I asked my parents, how many grades are there? And they didn't know. So they were like hands-off in some really important ways, but then really empowering in some other ways. And my favorite poster when I was a kid was something my dad got me. It's this girl, she's probably like 8 or 9, and she's topless, and she's got her jeans on and her fists on her hip, and she said, don't pee in my jeans, G-E-N-E-S, no nukes. And this kind of like child rights thing was like what I grew up with. So I think that this idea of adultism is very much at the core of the Magda Gerber stuff that I started with, which is, you know, we really do, kids and adults are different. You know, we do them a disservice to treat them like adults. I mean, I tell my kids all the time, you are not an adult when you start puberty, you are not an adult when you get a car, you're not even an adult when you leave your home. Actually, biologically wired, you don't really become an adult until your early 20s. And that's okay. Like, I'm here for you to support you because your brain can't do some things. You know, there's judgments, there's you know, brains develop over time. And so I think that if we can accept that there is a maturation, like a biological maturation process, and give kids age-appropriate decision-making authority, I don't think it's adultism so much as it is kind of acknowledging, it's silly you wouldn't, you know, my partner's father has Alzheimer's, right? There's appropriate ways for him to make decisions and have autonomy, and inappropriate ways. And so it's about attending to and making space for autonomy and respect within somebody's abilities.
The person who asked that question, is that what you meant?
Oh.
Where are you? What did you mean?
So adulthood is the oppression of young people by adults and elders.
It is an ism. It's pressure. The
pressure. Okay, pressure. Are you saying it's pressure to be an adult? Or
no, just like being like using yourself as an adult, but you're not young enough. to be seen as an adult, like oppression.
Oppression. It is an ism.
Oppression of children by adults?
Or yes. young people by yes. adults and elders.
It's like old people not thinking like young people.
No, it's worse than that. It's oppression. It's in the same sense of almost all the other isms, whether it's sexism or racism or whatever.
Oh.
It's an adult imposing themselves upon.
Okay. Then I can say something. I mean, obviously any kind of oppression is wrong. I think there are a lot of ways in which adults, if you will, impose themselves on kids, and particularly parents. I'm a parent and a grandparent. And one of the ways, one of the sometimes subtle and not so subtle ways parents impose themselves on kids is to live their lives through their kids and insist their kids insist in a variety of ways, some subtle, some not, their kids be the people they imagined they would be. So, dad always wanted to go to law school, but couldn't afford it, and got shunted off to something else because the family was too poor. He's now made a bundle of dough, and his son is Dharma going to law school. Well, but maybe his son is not meant to be a lawyer. You know, there's so many, and I mean, that's obvious, but there are more subtle ways in which often parents, you know, the kids who are athletes or, you know, they're on a team, and those parents that just get into it and start, really inappropriately getting in the midst of battles with umpires and that sort of thing. They're living out their lives through their kids. We have lives, they have lives, and we have to respect our kids enough to help them to have the lives they're meant to have, not live out our lives.
Yeah, I just have a personal anecdote about this. So I was in marching band in high school, you know, stereotypical. It's in drumline though, so drumlines were cool. And there was this issue. So I grew up with my grandparents. So my grandparents had already kind of been through the whole, you know, be involved in sports and all that. So when I kind of came around, they just really, you know, they did not want to be PTA president and all that. And one of the interesting things within, you know, the parents of the marching band was parents were so invested in their children's lives, but in not a healthy way, to the point where there were parents of kids on the marching band that I wasn't even friends with, yet they knew my personal dating life. That's kind of unhealthy. And so it's this interesting thing of that parents, I saw with, you know, they were trying to relive their high school experience through their kids, which is just not healthy. And I also think what was so interesting is they tried to relive their lives through their children, yet they had absolutely no idea who their kids were or what was going on in their kids' lives. And I think it's so interesting that here's these parents who pride themselves on being so involved in their children's lives, yet have not a clue of what's going on in a high school setting or college setting. And it, to the point where the parents feel that they know so much that they can now judge other kids and size the other kids up to their own children, of especially when we were going to college, of, well, you know, my kid got into Berkeley, and like, well, you only got into state school. And, you know, kind of all these interesting inner dynamics between the parents, of parents who are competitive than the children were about our children's future. And so it's kind of a little personal anecdote about how I think some parents take it a little too far.
One more thing about this. Probably the most damaging place parents do this is failure. Parents don't want their, I mean, legitimately don't want their kids to feel pain. But guess what? There's no way of getting through life without feeling pain. But I think frequently parents try to prevent their kids from failing because it becomes their failure. And the truth is, failure is part of growing up. It's part of the deal. It's what we learn most from. And when parents spend all their time making sure their kids never fail, they're stunting their growth. Different kind of oppression, but it's real.
Okay. So this question is very similar to the last question about adultism. The high school junior wrote or asked, What do you do when you're attempting to learn from yourself and gain experience, and there are individuals in life who keep interfering?
It sounds like something for a therapist, doesn't it?
Not disturbing. It's a hard one, right? I mean,
go ahead.
So, you know, so I sort of said this thing of like stay in your lane, right? And some of that is coming as a parent perspective, right? Make some space, set out the expectations, but after that, there's a lot of area where kids need autonomy and freedom. I mean, I also manage a nonprofit. It's a similar sort of thing, you know? I manage a team of people, some of whom do work. It's really different from the kind of work that I do. You know, I say what we need to have done. It's not just a top-down. We decide what it is we're working on, what needs to be done. And then within that, there's a lot of autonomy and decision-making. And so, you know, sort of the managerial version of this is calling it micromanaging. And you know, what I'm really hearing here is, you know, a sad cry to say, like, I want to be free to make mistakes. And I really hear that and value that and actually really respect that, because I think so often in our culture, mistakes are like supposed to be like hidden and brushed away. My sister's a middle school math and science teacher, my partner's an engineer and high school teacher, and you know, there can be no learning without mistakes. And so they both really focus on celebrating mistakes. Like, if you're not making mistakes, you're not stretching, you're not being given the opportunity to stretch and grow. And, you know, I think this interpersonal piece of like, and somebody keeps getting in your way, is really hard when you're in, you know, frankly, a less powerful position. I mean, I'm hearing this.
Welcome to life. Unfortunately, there are all these other people out there, and they do cross our paths, and sometimes at incredibly inconvenient times and in inconvenient ways. I suspect some of the people that whoever asked the question was talking about are parents, people that you can't easily control and have trouble saying, please, I need time to myself. The interesting thing, you know, one of the most magical moments about parenting is when your kids come to you the first time and actually talk to you as adults. You know, you're used to them saying, will you just get out of my life, or slamming the door or whatever, you know. And instead of doing that, they come down and they say, can I talk to you a minute? And they take control of the conversation, and they sit there and say to me, you know, I know you don't realize it, but earlier today, you know, when you walked into my room and I was actually in the middle of something, and I know you were trying to help, but I really needed time on my own. And you sit there as the parent and say to yourself, oh my gosh, wow, he's growing up. So if you can get beyond your emotions in that moment and realize, you know, something your parents probably said to you, we sure said to our kids, you didn't come with an instruction booklet, you know? We don't know any better how to do this than you do. In some ways, and I keep saying, you know, my kids taught me how to be a parent, and sometimes that's what you have to do.
I just want to say the fact that whoever sent in this like question is a junior in high school. Like, the fact that you're sitting here right now and even asking a question, like, you're way ahead of your time. So, like, props to that. I mean, I definitely agree with what the two panelists said about, you know, feeling like you can't grow up because you have obstacles in the way. But I would say I think there's two different types of obstacles. You know, there's the obstacles with, you know, your relationship with your parents or family who keep nagging you, but there's also these obstacles in friendships, or, you know, people who, you know, because as you're going to grow up, and one thing that I've really struggled with in college is realizing as you're growing up, people will take different paths. And you know, you're not going to stay friends with everyone. I had people who I thought I was going to be friends with forever, and we just want different things. Maybe later down the line, I'm going to reconnect with them. And I think just being aware of the fact that, you know, you don't have to keep everyone around. Like, you're going to change, and you're going to go through things, and people are going to challenge you. And I think in a lot of ways, some of those people that I viewed as obstacles, I'm the most thankful for now, because I learned the most from those types of people, because they did challenge me to think about, well, how do I actually feel about a situation, or who do I actually want to be? So, yeah.
Okay, we're about to get to it. I've been waiting for these questions to come about the how. And so, the first one, the three how questions that I have here is this one, and this is also from a student. How do you create separation from emotionally controlling parents to live the life you would like to live? They give an example. I'm about to graduate, want to stay in Colorado, but parents will be here, I'm not sure I can read the rest of it, and don't want me to go home. And want me to go home. So the question is, how do you begin to break away from this emotionally controlling environment? This is one of the first how questions, y'all.
I started an international fellowship organization about 20 years ago, and I was with one of our fellows just recently, who is in exactly that situation, and he is a number of years beyond whoever asked that question. For some people, it never goes away. There are parents who are controlling and who are living out their lives through, and you know, it's fine for us to sit here and say they shouldn't do that, but parents do. So how do you deal with that? This is not a guarantee of success, okay? But it's a recommendation that may work. And that is, take control of the conversation. One of the things that tends to happen in that situation, you've been living with these same parents all of your lives, and they press your buttons. And so, when your parent says something that threatens your adulthood, you tend to respond as a child. So surprise them and don't do that. One way of doing that, if you know that every time you get in a conversation, the buttons get pressed, you end up saying stuff you didn't mean to say, that sort of thing, do something that no one does these days. Sit down and write a letter. And write a letter that begins by realizing where they are and take them for the human beings they are. And say to them, you know, I am imagining that my graduating from college is a bittersweet thing for you. You're proud of the fact that I'm doing it. You're scared to death you're never going to see me again. That's not true. You know, I love you. But there's some things I need to talk to you about what I see about my future, where I want to go, what I really care about. And I want a chance to sit down with you and talk about this stuff. And your letter can be sort of the introduction to that adult conversation that I talked about. Not everybody's parents are going to respond to that, but they're more likely to respond to that than the response you usually have.
And here's another really provocative and interesting question. See if I can hold on to more of the audience here. How would you respond to intercultural views of adulthood, specifically when it comes to culturally prescribed rites of passage? In a word, is there a universal view of grown-upness?
It's an excellent question, and I think this is a good opportunity to talk about diversity and representation at the Conference on World Affairs. I think I can only speak from my perspective and my worldview, and I think that is a shortcoming, and I think it's a wonderful question that should be addressed, and I feel inadequate to do so.
I certainly second that. The Conference on World Affairs panelists are not paid to come here. We're here because we love this conference. And so every year getting 100 panelists is a lot of work. I don't do it. I was just one of the panelists who's here. But I will say that I've been to these conferences before, and there's been more diversity before. It's not intentional, but I would urge you all to say we need more of it, because the more points of view we have, the better. I'm going to take a stab at it, though. Certainly there are lots of different rites of passage that are important in people's growing up that are culturally related. And they make demands on each of you that can be difficult in the pluralistic culture in which you live. So, you know, you're 13 and you're Jewish and it's time for a bar mitzvah, and you've got to spend a year preparing for that, and at the same time you are on a baseball team and the practices at the same time as Hebrew school, and those things are tough to negotiate. And every single culture makes those kinds of demands that become tough in a culture that doesn't even know those demands are going on. Life is in part about negotiating that stuff. And sometimes we negotiate it better than others. I will say, I think there's one universal about growing up, and that is what I talked about earlier, understanding, one, that you are limited, you will fail, you will die, and two, that there are all these other people out here that we need not only take account of, but to embrace.
Yeah, I definitely agree with the diversity statements, and I urge all of you guys to make suggestions. I know a lot of us have already this week about, you know, making the panel more diverse. And yeah, I mean, I can't really speak on a whole lot about, you know, cultural differences of growing up. However, I grew up in a very conservative white Christian household, and one of my best friends did not. She's black, and grew up in a very liberal household and goes to Berkeley. And yeah, I have seen different, you know, cultural trends of not really much about growing up, but about, you know, the things that worry us. You know, as a white woman, I don't have to worry about some of the things that my friend does. And, you know, I think the first step in that is for, you know, people who are privileged to realize that, you know, I go into a job interview and my experience is going to be different than a friend who might be a minority. So, you know, even though I can't speak on the exact differences, I would say that that's something to keep in mind.
Here's another good one on how. The questioner is asking, this is also a student, how has growing up changed across generations? How does this change? How do we deal with growing up well?
I think it would be really interesting. I know there's experts that work on these kinds of areas, but to just think about what parenting books look like. And one thing, there weren't parenting books until fairly recently, but there were, you know, for the last 50 years or so. And I think there's a growing focus on happiness. And I do believe that previously there was more focus on kind of a meaningful life. And I believe that's to the detriment, actually, of people's happiness. I don't think you can be actually happy without a meaningful life. And I think you know, people say, like, what do you want for your kids? I just want them to be happy. And it goes along a little bit with something that you had said previously about removing pain. There's this idea that, you know, parents can kind of like smooth the road and there will be no hardship. You know, this is really, I mean, talk about, you know, first world problems, right? Like this is, you know, just such an embodiment of the privilege that we all, a privilege that I and mainstream culture embody, you know, that there's like this kind of ability to smooth the road in advance of your children. And one thing, just an anecdote that I'll share, my brother is 15 years younger than me and I had been a nanny. I had been around babies and children and I thought that I could handle crying. And then my oldest daughter was born and I am telling you that baby cried and it was like jump. You know, I was living in a co-op, people wanted to talk, they were like, so we're gonna stop everything, can't you hear the baby is crying? We have to fix this. And it was a new experience for me to have such an intense reaction to crying. Like, nothing else can happen until we have fixed the problem. And so, you know, I want to fess up, like, that's there. I have had that experience. And I, again, I was living, because I do live in Berkeley and I am a walking stereotype, I was living in a co-op, same house still. And one of my housemates is a PhD in psychology and biology from Berkeley, and she said, you know, there's actually studies that show that rats that don't experience stress don't do well. And it was I can't cite the study, you know, it's a bunch of years ago now, but it was a helpful idea for me to really begin grappling with something that was a struggle for me. I knew this wasn't right, but it was just such an intense reaction I was having. And it really gave me an opportunity to think, my job is not to solve things, it's to teach my kids the skills to solve it themselves. And I really try to, I think I've internalized it much more. Like, my job is not to fix the problems, but it's to support kids, my kids, so that they can get there themselves and get them the tools.
I think one of the biggest changes from when I was growing up is the lack of intergenerational experience.
Yes.
And not just for you guys, for us guys.
Yes.
You know, the number of, I mean, how many of you growing up had grandparents in the same town?
Mm. Well, that's good.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
The fact is that more and more kids are growing up without adults besides their parents that they've been close to. You know, kids had scout leaders, coaches, teachers they were close to, aunts, uncles, friends, parents, and so on. And while those people are, in some cases, still around, there's less intergenerational space, less chance to really develop relationships. The fact is, part of growing up is splitting off from your parents. You need to separate from your parents so that you can become an adult. But that doesn't mean you don't need adults anymore. And, you know, I hope in this environment where you've got faculty around, and I know this is a great big place, but a lot of the faculty are as eager to have relationships with you as you may be with them. So don't be shy about seeking it out. I think in today's world, if you're gonna have adult mentors, many of you need to make it happen. It used to happen more naturally, but make it happen because it will so enrich your life.
Yeah, I agree. I think that with social media, it's caused this really big echo chamber, especially for our generation of, you know, kids are relying on other peers to solve problems. And I think we try and compare our lives to other people through social media. And I do encourage everyone to find an adult mentor or figure that you do look up to, you know, whether that be within a church or a faculty member or, you know, somebody else. But I do encourage people to, you know, reach out and find a mentor that's not in your immediate family, because then you're not receiving kind of this biased view. You know, even at this conference, I met Frank for the first night and really was fascinated to hear about his, you know, spiritual journey as a priest and all these kinds of things. And, you know, as a 21-year-old, I'm having the time of my life being able to be around all these professionals and inspiring human beings. And I do encourage you to, you know, seek out these people, because there are a lot of people who do want to help the younger generation. And I think that's one of the misconceptions in the media is, well, older people view millennials as stupid or that we're lazy. And yeah, maybe some people do, but I think the reason why that is because I think both generations misunderstand one another. And I think that if we start having these conversations, we're going to start to see we're actually more alike than different.
And it will be a gift to them, as you end the day.
I think this next question is a fun one. It may not be in the mind of the person who wrote it. How do you deal with a young adult who doesn't want to take on the responsibility of becoming an adult? That is, failure to launch by the young adult.
I don't know. I mean, you know, I want to say that these are relationships that develop over years, right? And so, you know, I think Frank, you so eloquently spoke about, you know, some of the challenges of, from the kid side of separating, you know, here's the adult speaking, trying to figure out the separation. But in both cases, the similarity is that there's presumably close to 20 years of habitual patterns built up. And, you know, the kid is failing to launch for a reason, right? And so I don't know the answer because that's not my job. and I think there is always going to be specific and individual and unique. In my family, there are two young men, boys of a generation that are both a little bit younger than me, who both arguably had some of that problem, and the mothers on both sides had been, I'll just be really blatant, I feel like had sort of helped create that problem, had been over-invested, and their sisters, and they started talking, and they took different approaches, and one of the approaches was, you know, to cut ties and actually to set a limit and say, I'm not comfortable subsidizing, you know, here's my income, here's what I can do, I can't continue to subsidize financially you living here for this period of time. It took a pretty hardline approach on that seemed to work. The other parent took a different approach. And here's what I want to say about it. At the end of the day, they're both awesome men. And so my biggest takeaway from anything talking about parenting is there are a lot of ways to get there. There is no one single right way. There will be hiccups and bumps and, you know, so-called mistakes on the way. But for most people, they're gonna grow up and it might, you know, be a little painful on the way, but they're gonna get there. And there really isn't a single right path or a single right answer to a question like that.
One of the mistakes I think all of us make is assigning a timetable to all this. You know, you've been in school all your lives and you know you're supposed to get to a certain point by a certain age. It's over. You know, from here on out, there is no timetable. There are timetables you watch other people take, but that doesn't mean that's your timetable. Now, I'll say from the parent side, that can be a little tough. There you are back in my basement, and I really want my basement to be doing other things and to see you out there doing other stuff. Karuna's absolutely right. Each case is different, and the first thing you've got to do, not just as a parent, but sitting down with your son or daughter, is try to get a sense together of what's happening. You know, is there really a failure to launch, or are you just not there yet? Are you depressed? Are you just having trouble finding a job, which is easy, and, you know? Are you having trouble figuring out what you really care about? And that's usually the case, that you're being shunted in one direction and you really haven't stopped to think, what do I really care about? And how can I, you know, find a way of living my life so that I can do something about those things I really care about. So it involves some patience and a lot of conversation and a lot of love and some limit setting and helping your son or daughter to know that you actually have confidence they can take responsibility for themselves, even when maybe you don't have all that confidence.
Yeah, I'll share like a short thing because we have to wrap up a little soon. But I think a perfect example of this is us and my dad. You know, I think that some people grow up right away and some people take a long time, and kind of what Karina was saying, of, you know, a little bit of limit setting and tough love. And, you know, my dad was a little lost, and I think it's because he really didn't know what he wanted to do with his life or felt a purpose, and, you know, just kind of had some broken relationships growing up. And, you know, at the young age of 18, got kicked out of the house and had to live on his own. And that's how my grandparents kind of, you know, dealt with my dad, not just, you know, failing to grow up, but failing to, you know, be a responsible person and a loving person. And so, you know, I can't totally say and like talk on this issue because I haven't personally had a failure to launch, but I do look at my dad now as a successful person. He's totally fine, and he's happy as ever. I mean, he lives like the greatest life. He lives right on the beach and has no responsibilities besides his job and golfing. But, you know, so I guess like just viewing from my dad of realizing that everyone is gonna walk a different journey and everyone will eventually get there, but you know, don't totally beat yourself up if you're 20 years old and don't know what you're doing.
We probably have more questions than we can be able to address in the 9 minutes that we have left, but here's one that I think is gonna take you the tone a little differently. Can you speak about the loneliness felt on the path of growing up or coming to realization? Do you agree? Disagree? This is from another student.
Absolutely. I think one of the pieces of growing up is learning to be alone without being lonely. And that isn't easy. I have to tell you one moment, I'll tell one moment of my own growing up. I was 30 years old and in my first year of seminary. I decided to take a 6-week hajj through Egypt, Israel, Turkey, Greece, and Italy. And I was traveling alone. The interesting thing about traveling alone is that people immediately gravitate to you because they're tired of the people they're traveling with, and you represent something new. So even though I was traveling alone, I was almost never alone. I met people on the plane, I met people where I was staying, I'd, you know, walk into a restaurant, and, you know, people, I just constantly meeting people. One day, I was on the island of Crete, and I checked into a hotel, and I didn't speak the language. The hotel seemed like a crappy little hotel. I don't know why that particular day I was feeling as lonely as I was, but I was as lonely as I've ever been in my life. I walked into my crappy little room. I sat down. I thought, what the heck am I doing here? And then I thought, oh, wow, you know, I was going to Heraklion, which is a site and a palace. And I thought, well, if I do that now, get that all in, I could actually check out of this hotel. I don't need to spend the night, and then I'll, you know. So I'm driving there, and suddenly I hit the brakes, pulled off the road, and said, what are you doing, Frank? Stop. And I finally stopped long enough to think, something's going on here. you're not going to Iraq, go back to that hotel. I went back to my room. The room of this hotel that I was staying in hung out over the Mediterranean Sea. Somehow I missed that guy. I rearranged the furniture so that there was a desk in the room. I put it right under the window, and I sat and I wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. And at the end of the writing, I looked out. There were storms coming in over the Mediterranean. They were passing by my window. And this crappy little hotel became the most beautiful sight. I was just enraptured with where I was. Loneliness had turned to the capacity to be alone. And when I finally was willing to be alone, miracles happened.
Great.
In the 5 minutes that we have left, panelists, I'm going to try to summarize because we won't be able to get through all five of the cards I have here. This audience has seemed to have had an interest in the idea of adulting. And the last question I think really captures this concern about adulting. The question is adulting a never-ending process? So in 5 minutes, I'd like to see what all three of you might have to say about this. I mean, your best thoughtful response to it. Because it does, like I said, seem to be a question that this audience has. Not everybody, but a number of people in the audience.
I shouldn't have sat next to the moderator. It doesn't give me enough time.
I'm gonna spare you. I'm actually gonna take one from the team here. Although Frank has probably got it under control.
He's had more time to adult than the rest of us. I'm taking adulting in two ways, and so I want to say, on the one hand, if adulting is doing the things that you just have to do to maintain yourself, yeah, that never goes away. And in fact, hate to break it to us all, but you know, I work in cancer. It's going to get worse, right? Like what it takes to maintain our bodies gets harder and more complicated, and it's, you know, like the adulting parts of just like maintaining our existence is not going to lessen. That's going to increase in the big picture arc over the decades. But I want to take it another way, which is thinking about adulting as like not what it takes to maintain ourselves, but what it takes to live in this modern society. And that is where I feel like we all need to look at our lives and our values and what the economy, culture, society is asking and demanding of us. And if it doesn't feel like it's giving us the lives we want, to actually work to change the structures so that we can do less of that kind of adulting and more of the real living. And I think that actually is a collective endeavor. I think collective, you know, we have individual agency within this, right? But I think that collectively, there's a lot, you know, that we can do to really change the paradigm of the modern world and do less of some of the kinds of adulting that are really getting in the way of living.
If I understand adulting correctly, and I gotta tell you, I've never heard the word before an hour ago, it's almost playing at being an adult or doing the stuff you think you have to do to be an adult, like pretending to be polite when you'd really rather tell people to bug off and that sort of thing. I think part of becoming an adult is being able to take on the things that are natural to you in that and be able to learn how to negotiate your way around some of the phony stuff. I'm retired, and I gotta tell you, I love retirement. I don't love retirement because I'm no longer doing my old job. I have been very fortunate. In 50 years, I can only think of about three in which I was unhappy in what I was doing. 6% isn't bad. I've been blessed. But I gotta say, what's great about retirement, I decided in retirement two things. One, I would only do the things I really cared about. And two, I would not run anything. And by and large, I've been able to pull that off. Nobody's paying me for it, and that's kind of a bummer. But it means I can say no. It also means I can say yes to all that stuff I used to have to shoehorn in or be polite about and that sort of thing. And the result of that is that I feel like I'm being more naturally me than I've ever been in my life. I think, though, that didn't happen just the day I retired. It's been something that's sort of been growing, you know, all the way along. And it's not a straight line, because you backtrack and you regress and so on. But I think becoming an adult is more and more casting off the stuff you think is funny, and just becoming you and saying, hey, this is who I am, take it or leave it.
I just want to say one thing. I actually want to end on a joke that I really like, which I think will be good. So this kind of has to deal with our evolution. It says, at age 4, success is not peeing your pants. At age 12, success is having friends. At age 16, success is having a driver's license. At age 20, success is having sex. At age 35, success is having money. At age 50, success is having money. At age 60, success is having sex. At age 70, success is having a driver's license. At age 75, success is having friends. And at age 80, success is not peeing your pants. That's
it. Thank you for hanging in here with us. Please join me in thanking our panelists for today's very interesting.